Well, for those of you who received a copy of my testimony on email, you already know that I write longer testimonies than she does. So hopefully I will not go into as much detail as I speak this morning. I've lived longer than Steve, so that gives me a couple more pages to write about. Let me just go through what I've written, but I'm not going to go through it in all the specifics and details. And if I start to get too detailed and bogged down in the detail, raise your hand and I'll move on. I was born in 1947. February the 4th in Wichita, Kansas. I'm currently 67 years old, if you do the math. 6 months after I was born, my family moved to a small farm in Missouri. It was a 40-acre farm. Out of that, about 15 acres were actually tillable. And if you know anything about farming, that means that you're not raising a lot or you're not very prosperous as a farmer, but God blessed us in that we always had food and clothing and shelter. I attended the first three grades of school in a two-room schoolhouse. Grades 1 through 5 were in one room with Mrs. Boyer, the lady who taught me to read. She was the most beautiful and wonderfully smelling woman on the face of the earth. I just loved her. And then grades 6 through 8 were in the other room. Our house was, and Dorothy will correct me if I get this wrong, so I'm going to try to get it right. Our house had no running water and no heat. We had a wood-burning stove in what was the living room, which was very small. I thought it was big because I was a little boy. I went back to visit it many years later, and the whole house, I don't think, was much bigger than my living room, or maybe my living room and dining room now, very small. It had one room that was used as a bedroom, one room was a living room, one room was a kitchen, and then there was a back porch where my two oldest sisters slept. That was their bedroom. We had an outhouse. We had to go outside to pump water. And that's kind of how I grew up until I was 9 years old. When I was 9 years old, we moved to Wichita, Kansas. We had suffered some kind of financial disaster. As I recall, my father was raising thousands of chickens, and they got a disease, and like 5,000 of them died. And it was something we couldn't recover from. So he sold the farm, we moved to Wichita, Kansas, and lived in downtown Wichita for about a year. After that, we moved to the country outside of Wichita, which was near a little town called Derby, Kansas. And all this time, my mother had been taking us to church. My father never attended with us. We went to a Nazarene church in Missouri. What I did not write is a little anecdote, which is the thing that I remember most about the church in Missouri, the Nazarene church in Missouri. We were between pastors one time. We had a guest preacher, and he was a young man from the Nazarene Seminary someplace, I believe. But he was a young man. And that particular morning, my mother had allowed me to sit on the front pew, right next to the front of the church. And this church had a platform, like a stage, and then a pulpit on top of the platform. And the preacher was up high, and I was sitting there on the front, right next to the center aisle, watching him. And Nazarene preachers in the country got really excited about things. And this guy got really excited, and in the middle of, I didn't know exactly what he was excited about, but in the middle of his sermon, this is no lie, he jumped from flat-footed completely over the top of the pulpit and landed on the floor right in front of me. And that was the most astounding thing I had ever seen anybody do, any place. And he was obviously full of the Spirit. The one thing that did happen to me, as I mentioned in my testimony, in this Nazarene church, was that during a vacation Bible school, the preacher was down front and was talking about sin and salvation and hell, and I realized I was bad. I had some deep sense of sin, and I knew it was terribly bad, and I didn't want to go to hell, and I began sobbing, and I walked down front, and the pastor was very comforting. I was maybe 6 or 7 years old. He tried to comfort me and told me that he would talk to me later when I got older, and I was very disappointed because I thought he didn't think I was serious about wanting to know God. When we moved to Kansas, and then when we were, after my father built a small house outside of Derby, my mother and I began, and I think my two older brothers began attending the First Baptist Church of Hayesville, Kansas, which was fairly a few miles from us, maybe 3 or 4 miles from us. And it was a Southern Baptist church. I made a very good friend there. And when we were 12 years old, he was at the end of the service. He began crying and wanted to walk forward and be saved, but he wanted me to go be saved with him. Now, I wasn't crying at all because I had not been affected by the sermon or whatever the preacher said, but I went forward with him to be saved, and I think we were then baptized that night. It was either that night or the following Sunday evening, but I believe it was that night. And in that church, I attended Sunday school and worship service and royal ambassadors and the things that boys 12 to 13 years old did for a while. Shortly after that, that church established a Baptist mission, and it was a Broadway Baptist mission, which was maybe about a mile from our house. And it was called Broadway Baptist Mission because it was on South US 81 Highway. It was named Broadway. That was the name of the street. The pastor was Kenny Bolton. He visited us, and he was a young guy, and very funny and energetic, and loved kids, and one of those kind of guys, and a very good man. And we began attending there, and the church had very few men who could read well. They were semi-literate or illiterate, so Kenny Bolton thought it was a good idea to make me a Sunday school teacher when I was 16 years old, and I did that. When I was 17 and 18, he was attending seminary. By then, I was in debate in high school, and I had learned to organize a speech and not be afraid to speak in public. So he thought it would be a good idea if on Wednesday nights, when he had to be in Kansas City for seminary, I would lead the services on Wednesday nights, which I did. And he actually had me preach on Sunday morning a couple of times. This is all scary stuff. This is very... because I wasn't saved. Anyway, in my senior year in high school, actually my junior year, I met Felda Delamarter, who probably lifelong was my dearest friend. She passed away a few years ago, but she took a special interest in me, kind of adopted me into her family, and she would bring me home after school, and I'd have dinner with she and her husband and her children. She had a daughter in the same grade as I was in. And Felda was a great encouragement to me. I would talk with her about church and religion and literature. When was in my senior year, she mentioned that the Methodist Church provided full 4-year scholarships to pre-ministerial students. So I became a Methodist right away and talked to their committee. They gave me a 4-year scholarship to Southwestern College. I attended one semester, had decided I'd fallen in love with a young lady and didn't want to be that far away from home or away from her, left after the first semester. And went to work, got married. My father passed away. I'm kind of moving through some things rapidly now. About 8 months, 7 months after I was married, went into the Army. I was a paratrooper in the 101st Airborne Division. I went to Vietnam, was medically evacuated out of Vietnam with severe mastoid infections in my left ear, and had a couple of surgeries in Japan, was sent to Colorado, Fitzsimmons General Army Hospital in Denver, Colorado, to recover. Then was assigned there as a duty station. I brought my wife and child. Thomas had been born in January of 1967. Moved down from Kansas to Colorado, and we lived there for a few months, about a year perhaps. During that whole period of time, our marriage was very troubled, lots of problems in our marriage. I had begun drinking in high school, continued drinking in the military, and in Colorado had really developed a lifestyle that included partying with my friends and everything connected with that, which was, if you remember, that was the 60s and early 70s. So that was, we thought we invented everything. And we didn't invent it, but we took, as a generation, we seemed to take what was sinful and evil to new levels. After about a year, we moved back to Kansas and separated. We were separated for a little over a year, maybe almost 2 years. We reunited in the marriage. A couple of years later, my oldest daughter, Juliana, was born. Tommy is currently 46 and Juliana is 41. During that period of time, I was going to college. I graduated from Wichita State University with a bachelor's in American literature and a master's in literature. I went from graduating to working construction for a few months until I could find a job with AT&T as a marketing manager. And after a few months of that, I was hired to work for the United States Penitentiary, which is the Federal Bureau of Prisons in Leavenworth, Kansas. My wife and I then were separated a couple of more times during this period of time, and I eventually transferred from the Bureau of Prisons to the Veterans Administration and reunited with my family. However, we divorced in 1979. Shortly after I divorced, my mother died, and I went back to the Bureau of Prisons. I worked at the United States Penitentiary in Lompoc, California, as the Human Resources Director. I met Patricia in 1981. She was working for the Bureau of Prisons also. She was, at that time, she was working in the central office in Washington, D.C., and I met her on a business trip to Washington, D.C. Actually, one of my friends who had worked for me in Lompoc knew her, was working with her, and introduced us. He had talked to me on the telephone and said, "You need to meet this young lady," and he had talked to her about me. Neither of us were Christians. Something you don't know about Patricia, she used to be a firearms instructor with the Bureau of Prisons in Denver, Colorado. So that might give you a new picture of this sweet little lady. We married in 1982, June 5th of 1982. We will be married 31 years this coming Wednesday, for which I thank God every day. Out of all of the wonderful things that God has given me in life, and there are many, Patricia is the greatest earthly gift that I've ever experienced, that I could ask for. Now, I would say, and that. I think she's the greatest earthly gift that anyone could have, but I know that there are other men that would disagree with that. But she has just been a marvelous and wonderful, wonderful wife. We were not Christians when we were married. I was drinking heavily, and I was a very bad man. And she persevered, and I will be forever thankful to God for giving me Patricia. In 1984, I became a deputy warden in Lake Placid, New York, upstate New York in the mountains. My life had become worse and worse for all kinds of reasons. Although I was getting promoted and making more and more money and having a better career, I was miserable. I was drinking more. I was alcoholic. And I had come to the point that I no longer wanted to live, and I realized that, and it terrified me, and I began to pray one early Saturday morning, God, if you exist, let me believe in you and change my life. And that's the only prayer I could pray for months, because I did not really have a sense of believing in God. I had turned away, become an existentialist, and had abandoned all of my concepts of God. So I was very hopeless and lost, but I was afraid to die. I knew how serious my condition was, because in my position, one of my responsibilities was to manage suicide prevention programs for prisoners. So I knew that at the stage of my thinking and feelings, I was in bad shape, and I was terrified. And so I continued praying this prayer, began attending AA, at Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of God, began to put a little distance between me and that compulsion, that control in my life. I was transferred to Danbury, Connecticut. There, we had a pastor from Scotland come and preach for us and become our preacher. And I'd never heard anyone preach like he preached. And he was an expository preacher. I didn't know that at the time. But he asked me to meet with him for a few weeks. I think in conversation with me, he kind of got my number. And he asked me to meet with him for a few weeks. And one of the first things that he began talking about was 1 John 2:4. He who says, I know him and does not keep his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. And that verse, I'd never heard it before, and it just cut into my soul. And I knew that I had not kept God's commandments. I could look back over my life. And I had thought when I started attending this little church in Danbury that, well, I'm probably a Christian because I've done everything they told me to do. I walked down the aisle, said the prayer, got baptized, and then I lived the rest of my life in complete rebellion and rejection of God. But I was very confused, and I came to the point that I prayed, If I am saved, please give me assurance of my salvation. But if I'm not saved, Lord Jesus, let me believe in you and save me. Give me faith and save me. And I can look back a couple of years later and see that that's really the point at which God saved me. Because then I began to experience a peace in my life. And I began to see change, just one change after another in my life. As I began to see sin and by the grace of God turn from those sins. During that period of time, I got a phone call one Saturday afternoon, and there was this church in New Milford whose pastor had left, and they asked me to preach for them for a couple of Sundays. I didn't even know them. The director of missions of the Southern Baptist Association in that area had spent some time talking with me at one time, and he had given them my name. So I thought, well, I will go speak for them. And that began an examination in my life of really what was God's purpose for my life now. And shortly after that, I was given an opportunity to work with the Salvation Army, which I did for about a year, year and a half. We operated a street mission, really, the Christian Eye, one night a week, and then on Sundays. We did that Sunday mornings and would take all the homeless people, try to encourage them to go over to the Salvation Army for worship service, preaching service. And since I was a deputy warden, and we had a camp, which is a minimum security facility. It was a camp with female inmates. I was able to get the warden to allow me to take van loads of female inmates down to the Salvation Army on Sunday evenings to hear preaching, which was a wonderful thing. And I was just, at that time, responding to opportunities. I would have opportunities for service or to do things that I thought were for the purpose, and I believe them to be of bringing this wonderful news of Christ, this wonderful truth of the Bible that God had used to save me, change me, deliver me to other people. After 4 years in Connecticut, I was transferred to California. In August of 1990, I took a trip with a man named Dr. Richard Belcher to India. He had given me, part of the requirement of taking the trip is that you speak, teach or preach on the trip. And the first night we were in New Delhi, I spoke. And the next day, we had a flat tire along the road, and while we were waiting for the drivers to go someplace and get the tire fixed at this little kind of open market place, Pastor or Dr. Belcher came up to me and said, "Boy, you got to preach now." He called me boy. I was 42 years old. But he said, "Boy, you need to preach. You can preach." And I said, "I'm 7 years, 8 years away from finishing a career." And he said, "Well, that's okay. You don't have to do it full time. Just go to seminary, because if you start taking some classes in seminary, churches that need preachers to fill pulpits call seminaries." That's exactly what happened. I ended up attending seminary, which actually started about a year and a half later, because Patricia was pregnant with Hannah. That whole year was full of the pregnancy, Hannah being born. But I began seminary at the Golden Gate Southern Baptist Seminary Extension in Brea, California, which is in Los Angeles County. And, no, actually, I think that's Orange County. Brea is in Orange. Began seminary, taking classes part-time, and in late 1992, preached at the First Baptist Church in Lawndale, small church, about 17 people. They immediately wanted me to be their pastor, and I said, "Oh, I don't know about this." Part of the reason was that we would have to move from upscale, suburban, 4,000 square foot house in Orange County to 960 square foot house in the ghetto. And that's too strong a word for it, but it was the inner city where this church was located. And I was concerned about my family and concerned whether this is really what God wanted me to do, whether I should do this. So I told them I would preach for them for 6 months, and at the end of that 6 months, we would both decide if that's what I should do. And I ended up then serving in that church for 3.5 years. I was ordained in early 1993. Since the church had just a few people, and they really weren't equipped to assess whether or not someone should be ordained. I called on the Los Angeles Southern Baptist Association and the elders of that association, actually the pastors, to serve as an examining committee, and they participated in the ordination. Jeremiah, my daughter Hannah was born in March of 1991. Jeremiah was born in August 1993. The Longdale Church was very interesting. It was a small church in a small facility. It had really two fairly good-sized buildings. The sanctuary could hold maybe 100 people. And then there was a long building that was used for Sunday school and a number of other things. But over the years, as people moved out, they would donate their house and land, their house, to the church. Or some of the people would will it to the church. So the church owned four houses and a duplex plus the church property. And you have to get a picture of this. This is in L.A. County. It is less than a mile from the beach. This is potentially very high dollar property, but it had not been cared for in 25 years. It was in horrendous shape. So we set about to renovate the properties and get tenants, get the rents back where they should be, and be good stewards of the property the Lord had given the church during that period of time. The attendance increased from 17 to about 55. I've mentioned in my written testimony that I baptized, I think, 13 or 14 people there. Just doing what I've been taught to do. And after a fairly short period of time, those people no longer attended church and gave no evidence of spiritual transformation in their lives at all. And that was very concerning for me. That caused me a great deal of trouble. And I was very concerned about what I was doing. The way I'd been taught, I had to persuade people, and for some reason I wasn't persuading them or teaching them correctly. So I was very concerned about that. After 3.5 years there, I was called to the Calvary Southern Baptist Church in El Monte. Huge facility. The sanctuary would seat over 500 people. It had seven large buildings on the property. It was almost 2 acres of land, maybe an acre and a half of land, 12 miles straight east of downtown Los Angeles, off the 10th freeway. In accepting that call, I had accepted it on the condition that the El Monte Church allow me to continue serving the Lawndale Church for at least 3 months until we could finish some of the projects we were in the middle of, and until we could locate someone to come in and serve as pastor, interim pastor anyway. And they were gracious and allowed me to do that. I later worked with the Lawndale Church to locate a permanent pastor, and he's still there. He's been there 17 years now. excuse me. There were 45 people in the first service I preached in the El Monte Church. For several years, our attendance averaged 75 to 85. When I first preached there, probably out of the 45, there were only about 5 of them that were under 70 years old. So fairly quickly, these people began to pass away, or they had to go live with relatives or children because they could no longer take care of themselves. I was concerned about the fact that it did not seem like there were enough people coming to Christ. I was preaching, I was working hard, I was doing a lot of these evangelistic things, had a lot of programs, and youth programs, and vacation Bible school. But I thought that I must be doing something wrong. I'm just not convincing enough people to be saved. And once they are saved, I seem to be training them well enough. I need to be training them better. But I came to a point where I needed to begin a new series of messages, and so I decided I would preach through Ephesians. And as I developed my sermon plan through Ephesians, I looked at Ephesians 1:7, and I thought, maybe one or two sermons here. I came to Ephesians 1:7, which says, "In him we have redemption through his blood, according to the riches of his grace." And I began studying to prepare to preach a message or two on that verse. And I realized I didn't have a full orbed, I didn't even have part of an orb, understanding of what redemption really meant biblically. Someone had referred me to John Murray's Redemption Accomplished and Applied, and I got that. And I had Louis Burkhoff's Systematic Theology, and I bought Martin Lloyd Jones' 5 or 6 volume set on Ephesians, and I began studying. And I spent 18 months preaching on redemption. And it was the most dramatic spiritual event, or event in my life of any kind, second only to my salvation. And what I was actually preaching was the doctrines of grace without knowing what they were or what they were called. Sometime after that, I met Earl Blackburn, and he introduced me to the 1689 London Baptist Confession. I'd never heard of it before. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a Reformed Baptist Church, let alone an association of Reformed Baptist Churches. I took a class at Westminster Seminary on the Confession. I began preaching, using the Confession as a lectionary or a guide for my sermons. I began teaching in the adult Sunday school, in the adult Sunday school class, the differences between the Southern Baptist Baptist faith and message and the London Confession. After about 2 years, I led the church to vote on Reformation, and the church voted to become a Reformed Baptist church and to disassociate with the Southern Baptist Convention, which we did. Might mention also that even before we reformed, I had taken a class, two classes actually. I studied Spanish for a year at community college. I had studied Spanish previously in high school, but I took two classes in Spanish, and I began preaching in Spanish, and preached in Spanish for 4 years. We had a small Spanish language congregation. I can sing in Spanish. I can pray in Spanish. I can talk Bible and spiritual things in Spanish, but I can't talk to you about food or baseball, or I don't have that vocabulary. But God blessed the church. You know, I think the greatest thing that came out of that whole Spanish ministry is that when I came into the Reformed Baptist circles, and eventually when we discontinued services at El Monte, and began attending Sovereign Grace Baptist Church in Ontario, I had a reputation for preaching in Spanish and having a Spanish ministry. So as soon as I went to the Ontario church, there was this couple, a Spanish-speaking couple, that approached me and said, "Oh, we're so glad you're here. We want to start a Spanish language ministry." And Patricia and I were already in the process of planning to move to Texas. And I told them at the time, I said, "Well, let me think about it for a while." So that's what I did. I thought about it. And I thought about it for a couple of months, and I finally met with them. And his name was Gilbert. And I told Gilbert, I said, "You know, I'll be happy to help you get this started, but you need to lead it." Gilbert had cancer, and had throat cancer. And he was concerned about the strength of his voice, but he decided he would be willing to do it. So he and his wife, I worked with them, I talked with the elders there at Sovereign Grace, and we began a Spanish language ministry. Gilbert died after about a year of working in that ministry. But another young man had come along who has a master's degree in theology, who's probably probably mid-30s, and he is now preaching in a Spanish language ministry in the Ontario Church to 60 to 65 people every Sunday, and they're getting ready to constitute as a Spanish language Reformed Baptist Church sometime this year, we hope. So out of all my Spanish experience, that's the thing I'm most happy about. And as far as what happened with the El Monte Church, we had about three years of wonderful ministry, peace and unity and love in the church, and great worship. It became clear after about 3 years that we simply could not maintain the facility without using all of the money we had in reserves. And it would have to be used fairly quickly, within a couple of years. And then we would be in the position of having to sell the property under financial duress. The community was comprised of about 60-some percent, 63-64% Latinos, 34% Asian, and 1-2% other, which did not include Caucasians. So they're just, short of a day of Pentecost event, which is a phrase I used in my written testimony, we were going to be faced in a couple of years with the need to sell the property quickly, and we did not want to be in that position. So I talked with the church members about it. We decided to discontinue services, sell the property, establish a foundation that would promote the gospel and gospel works, and that's exactly what we did. We sold the church in July of 2011, and September of 2010 we discontinued services, and I urged all of the people attending to go to Sovereign Grace with us, because that was closest, and most of them became members there and are still there. Patricia and I moved to Georgetown. We did not find a truly Reformed Baptist church in the greater Austin area. In talking with the elders at Ontario, we decided to meet with the elders in Dallas and at the Heritage Baptist Church in Mansfield. We met with them in January of 2012. I had been able to work for 3 or 4 months on putting together a proposal for a church plant here in Georgetown. We presented that. The elders of both churches then agreed that they would sponsor a church plant here. And that same day, to the surprise of everyone, Steve Garrick said, "I want to be the man to go do that." Now, I want to emphasize the importance of that, because myself and all of the elders said, we will not plant a church without two men. We need another man. And we said that during our conversations. So we talked about that. We all broke for lunch, came back from lunch, and Steve said, "What would you think about me doing it?" And we thought that was wonderful. And it has been. I have four natural children. Thomas is 46, Julianne is 41, Hannah is 22, and Jeremiah is 20. Joseph is 13, and he is adopted. And I have 7 other grandchildren. That's not as short a summary as I would have liked, but we do have time for a few questions, so let me try and answer any questions you might have. Rick?
I'm not clear on how you got associated with Sovereign Grace. They were 30 miles away of that church. Was that how you were looking around?
They were part of an association of churches called the Southern California Association of Reformed Baptist Churches. And even from the time I met Earl Blackburn, one of the first things he did was to invite me and the members of our church to begin to associate with them. So they have, that association has what they call quarterly gatherings. Once a quarter, on Sunday evenings. They all meet at one church someplace. There are about 10 or 11 churches in that association. They all meet at one church for a worship service. And they have a guest preacher and food. And so we began attending those quarterly gatherings. The Wednesday before the quarterly gatherings, or the week before the quarterly gatherings, that is, the elders of that association all meet. They have a business meeting. And so I began attending those. And that's how I became acquainted with Steve Marcadon and Jeff Massey.
You never did attend that church then?
After we discontinued services at El Monte, I became a member of the Ontario Church, and I am currently still a member of the Ontario Church. All right, Rick.
How did you pick Georgetown? You said you were planning to move to Texas. How did you end up here?
It was about a 2-year process. Originally, Patricia and I were not planning to move permanently. We were just looking someplace in the Midwest because we had a lot of family out here. And quite honestly, I'm 10 years older than Patricia, and we became concerned that I might die and leave her in California with no family. So we thought, well, we will find a place for us to that we can use as kind of a vacation home someplace. Kansas, Missouri, Texas was kind of the last place I wanted to come. Because the only thing I knew about Texas was West Texas and the swamps of Houston, you know, and because that's really the only places I've ever been in Texas. So we began looking around for places, and it was about a 2-year search. And when I came to Texas, I spent the first time a couple of weeks, I think, in Texas, just driving throughout and looking at different cities and different areas. And I liked Kerrville a lot, but I didn't like the housing that was available. And when I got to the greater Austin area, I really liked this area. So we began looking in this area. So there's nothing complicated about it. We just liked the area and ended up finding a house here. Sam.
You mentioned that you had worked in the Georgetown, Austin area, and you said that you didn't find a truly reformed church. What about Day Spring and High Point Baptist Church? What didn't meet the criteria for a truly reformed church for those churches?
Day Spring is a New Covenant dispensational church. And I'd be happy to talk with you about that in more detail sometime, but in terms of being a truly reformed church, I just don't see New Covenant theology and dispensationalism meeting that definition, I guess. High Point, if I recall correctly, hold to the New Hampshire Confession.
They do.
And the New Hampshire Confession has revised much and jettisoned much of the 1689 to make doctrine more palatable, in my opinion.
So by reform, you mean meeting the exact standards of the London Confession of Faith, as opposed to any other?
Well, I would say the London Confession, the Westminster, Presbyterians have baptism wrong and some other things, but when I think of reform, I think of those confessions. Other questions? If you have any other questions, you can feel free to call me, email me, see me after service sometime if there's something you would like to ask. My testimony is something that could cause people to have questions. You may have a question you don't feel comfortable asking publicly, and I will be happy to answer that privately. So do not hesitate to ask. In this entire process of consideration of elders, it is critical that you be able to have confidence in me and trust me. And if you don't, then please come and talk to me, and at least give me an opportunity to work with you and see if the Lord might work in those conversations in a way that you may come to trust me. Well, let's pray, and then we'll take a short break. Our Father in heaven, we are so thankful again for your wonderful grace in saving every one of us. We all have much in common when it comes to the testimony of the truth of your grace of salvation in our lives. We are all desperate sinners who need a Savior. And the only reason we can give testimony of being forgiven and of loving you is because you have taken the action to save us, and we thank you and worship you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.